these things I'm going to say today to heart. Okay? Because they're powerful. They're powerful in your life. When I was thinking about it, I think I mentioned last year, you know, there's a book by Stephen Covey. How many people ever heard of Stephen Covey? You know, he has a book, millions of copies sold, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. And I've heard different things by him, and he's dead now. He died, I think, in 212, but I like that he's a good guy. And as I've been going over my different things, I'm thinking, wow, this almost parallels a lot of the stuff that Stephen Covey. So what I did was I kind of took some concepts from his book with all the things I was teaching and combined it into one to make the Seven Habits become one of the 144,000. So even if you take one of these habits, they're powerful in your life. I mean really powerful in every aspect of your life. Because what we're going to talk today, I don't see capitalism as a good thing. Capitalism is a win-win. Capitalism is there's win-lose. But the winners keep moving on. And that's what they say. If 10 businesses start and 9 fail, so what? The one that continues, that's capitalism. But it's not the kingdom of God. And I saw a video a while ago. I don't know if you ever heard of a man called Glenn Beck. Anybody ever heard of him? No, he's a... And I think he's an honest guy. I met him in Israel one time. He was doing some things. And I think he's an honest enough guy. But he made a statement. He said... And he's supposed to be a believer. I think he's Mormon. You know, he's supposed to be a Christian or something. But he said, if you can give me a better government than America, I will leave America today. I said, oh, I wish I could get a hold of him. I wish I could get a hold of him. I can give him a better government than America. I'm not trying to save capitalism. I'm not trying to save the Constitution. I'm an ambassador for the kingdom of Yahweh. I got a better way. I got something that's way, way better. Because in that system there's always winners and losers. And the reason why it's lasted so long is there's always been a lot of people in the middle that really aren't a winner or a loser. And people were satisfied with that. People were satisfied with mediocrity. I'm not satisfied with mediocrity. Yahweh made me better than that. I hope you're not satisfied with mediocrity. We want to excel. It says whatever your hand puts to do it with all your might. Who wants to be mediocre? You know, anybody can be that. But the kingdom of Yahweh, we have a better way. We have a way that is always win-win. There are no losers in the kingdom of Yahweh. It's always win-win. And everything you do in life, when you're dealing with other people, it's got to be win-win. And since we come from a society that everything is either win-lose or lose-win, one way or the other, we have to reprogram our minds to that. And we have to make sure that we're always thinking in a win-win mentality. Win-lose is the way of Satan's system of commercial Babylon. Win-win is the kingdom mindset that we have to live in. And I said this competition is of the devil. You know, there's no competition in the kingdom of Yahweh, and we shouldn't be teaching our children competition except to yourself. You know, competition is good to yourself. You should be competing against yourself to do better, but not competing against another human. Right? Why would I compete against another human? He's not my Elohim. He's not going to be the one that judges me. You know, what difference does it make? What difference does it make if you're a little bit better than your neighbor if you're both going to go to Lake of Fire? Right? No, you want to compete against yourself. You want to be better. You want to overcome. But it's not about competition to each other because, again, every time there's competition, then there's always win-lose. And I wonder that sometimes. Even I see sometimes believers... playing games. I was shocked when I went into Church of God, because when I grew up from 4 years old playing sports. And I was good at sports and I loved it. I got scholarships, I loved playing, and it's very competitive. And I just loved it. I loved the aspect of it because it was something that I excelled at and I enjoyed. But I learned to get over it. And when I came into Church of God, and I'm thinking, you know, you're meeting people that are so friendly and giving, and boy, then you get on the basketball. You want to see people's character change? I couldn't believe it. I was shocked because the competitive nature comes out in people. It's like it's not right, so why put people up to that? It doesn't have to be that way. Think of something as simple as going bowling, right? Anybody ever bowled before, right? Why does it have to be that we're all bowling to see who gets the highest score? Why can't you just bowl as a family? And you just combine the scores together. Me and my daughter, we play some of the Brother Man different memory games, right? So we don't play the memory game, who gets more. We both do it. I flip one card, she flips the second. So there's no competition to it. We're playing as a team, we're playing together. That's the kingdom of Yahweh. The kingdom of Yahweh is not winners and losers. The kingdom of Yahweh is winners. It's winners, and you have to think this way. We have to think this way on win-win. And you have to think bigger than yourself to be in that kind of mentality. You have to think bigger than yourself to be in a win-win mentality. The earthly mind thinks on scarcity, because why do we think on win-lose? We think on win-lose because we're thinking that we're limited in resources, right? Like, okay, we're coming over here, there's sandwiches for lunch. And let me take three, because there might not be enough, right? But if, and that's okay, you know, if there's enough food, take four. But are you thinking of it? Are you thinking on scarcity? There may not be enough for me, so I'm going to take extra. That's not win-win. That's win-lose again, right? When there's one piece of cake left, and there's five people, right? You can split it in five ways, but that doesn't mean too much. That's win-lose. There's a win-lose mentality that's there, and it's everywhere in the world, I'm telling you. It takes a while to break it, but it is the most freeing thing in your life when you go to win-win. Because you want to know something? The kingdom of Yahweh is not scarcity. The kingdom of Yahweh is abundance. And when we're thinking that way, there's people that will think, and maybe they don't say it at times, but you're a piano player, and somebody else comes to the congregation who plays the piano, and they get jealous. Ooh, they might take my job away. Are they going to take your job away? You know? Isn't it more abundance when we have two piano players compared to one piano player? You've got to think in that mindset. The kingdom is a mindset of abundance. I've seen before, and this is something I don't understand. Somebody will be hoping to get a new car, and somebody else gets one. Another brother comes and says, hey, I was just blessed, I got one new Genesis. Can you imagine? And I say, is there one car in the world? Is there one car that he got a car, and you didn't get a car, and you're jealous? How on earth can you be jealous? I've seen people who can do it with someone getting a baby. You know, somebody got pregnant, the woman's jealous that she didn't get pregnant. Is there one child in the world? You're thinking little. You're thinking little. You know, you're not thinking in abundance, you're thinking in scarcity. Where are you going to end up that way? You know, you have to think in abundance. You have to think big if you want to be in the kingdom of Yahweh. Yahweh is a kingdom of abundance, not scarcity. You have to think and live in a mindset of abundance. Verse 21, and they shall not build houses, and they shall build houses and live in them. And they shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. And they shall not build and another live in them. And they shall not plant and another eat. For like the days of the tree are the days of my people, and my elect will grow old to the work of their hands. For they shall not labor in vain nor bring forth for terror, for they are the seed of the beloved of Yahweh, and their offspring with them. Wow, that's abundance. You know, there's times I'll go on a mission trip to a place like Africa, and I see somebody kind of like, I see them eyeing me down, you can tell it. And somebody will spend 2-3 days figuring out how to get $20 out of their pocket. You know, they give me every story in the world, this and that, and I say, wow, you're really thinking small. You know, you spent 2 whole days trying to figure out how to get $20 in my pocket. You know what? If you had a plan of action, and you had a budget here, you could have asked me for $1,000 for a business to help the congregation, and I'd give it to you right now. Why are you thinking so small? You know? And what are you going to do with that $20? $20 is going to come and go. That would mean nothing. But if you had a business, and you were producing mangoes, and you had mango trees, and they kept producing, now you're not only giving to the brethren, it's going to keep producing year after year. We have to stop thinking in scarcity and think in abundance. I was on the plane one time, and I was telling a guy, I joke when I do this, but it's a true story. You know, I'm sitting there, I'm talking to the person, and as I'm talking about businesses, I say, I don't really like to tell this to too many people, but I actually come from a really rich family, and you'll see their eyes kind of go up. And they'll say, oh, yeah. And I'll say, no, I don't think you understand. You know, I have a really, really rich family. And then they'll start, they own a corporation, you know, they own, yeah. I said, actually, my dad owns the universe.
But it's true. Can you imagine? We are children of the creator of the universe.
And we're worried how to get $20 out of somebody's pocket. You know, we're worried of little things, you know, how to pay the electric bill, how to do this. It's scarcity. It's not abundance. Yahweh's in abundance. And that's the great part about it is, in community, you have to think this way. And that's why I say, this is a community. If you don't have win-win, you have no community. And that's the for me, the hardest part of trying to set up a community is to get that in the mind. Because anybody can go, if you have money, and you can build houses. You know, you can plant fields, and you can put up whatever. But that doesn't make a community. You know how long that will last? It'll last a very short time if the people's mindset isn't there. You have to have that mindset of win-win. You have to have that mindset of love your neighbors yourself. And that's the only way it's going to work. Deuteronomy 28. You got to concept this. You got to concept how big Yahweh is. And how big his blessings are. Deuteronomy 28 says, if you shall care, and it shall be, if carefully you will listen to the voice of Yahweh your Elohim, taking heed to do all his commandments which I command you this day, Yahweh your Elohim shall give you to be on high above all the nations of the earth. And all these blessings will come on you and overtake you if you listen to the voice of Yahweh your Elohim. He will bless you in the city, and he will bless you in the field. The fruit of your body will be blessed, and the fruit of your ground, the fruit of your livestock, the offspring of your livestock, and the young ones of your flock. Your basket, your kneading trough shall be blessed, and you shall be blessed when you come in, and you shall be blessed when you go out. Yahweh will cause your enemies that rise up against you to be stricken before your face. They shall come out against you one way, and flee from you seven ways. Yahweh will command the blessing on all your storehouses, and all that you set your hand to do. And he will bless you in the land which Yahweh your Elohim has given to you. Yahweh will establish you a holy people to himself, as he has sworn to you, if you will keep the commandments of Yahweh your Elohim and walk in his ways. And all the people of the earth shall see that you are called by the name of Yahweh, and they will be afraid of you. Wow. They will be afraid of you. Can you imagine? You know? You're a child of the Most High. You know? You're a son or daughter there. And this is serious business when you're dealing this. And we have to think this way. Not for yourself. You have to think of this way for other people. You have to have a mindset of abundance, not scarcity. We're heirs of the universe. Yahweh's ways can give way, and there is abundance for everybody. Like I said, sometimes if somebody has a gift and somebody else comes in, and they might get jealous of it. But when you're looking into abundance, the more gifts that we have of somebody, the more people we have that can sing, right? Can you have a choir with one singer? Not really. Can you have a choir with 10 singers? Yeah, you know? So the more you have of a gift, the more abundance you're going to have. In New York City, there's different areas, there's different districts. And like there's one district called the Light District. And you drive up here for blocks and blocks and blocks, every single store is a different light store. And I used to work there. I used to work in New York. And somebody that was with me one time, they asked, they said, how do all these stores stay in business? If they're all selling the same thing, isn't it hard, you know, to compete against? He says, no, it's the opposite. Because do you know people will come from two states away because they know that light district? If they need something that's with lighting, they're going to come there? So that's the point. When you have abundance, you're going to get more people that want that. So it actually doesn't limit them to have 50 different stores, you know, that sell lights, or 50 different stores that sell clothing. It's the opposite. It's the opposite. It brings more business to them. And that's the mentality we have that. We have to understand that abundance brings more abundance. Right? Whatever you focus on becomes most real to you. Abundance brings more abundance. And that's the kingdom mindset. It's always got to be win-win. The whole is worth more than the individual pieces. I talked about this before. It was a conference I was at the Knesset a couple of years ago, And I just love that because it's so true that individually, we're only one number. We're five, we're two, we're eight. But when you put all of us together, all our numbers, the whole is worth more than the individual pieces. We can do so much more together. That's going to be number six, is going to be synergizing. You know, when you synergize, you can do so much more together than separately. So people that are out there that are against judicial order, right, and they say this, I'll never follow man and I don't want to be under that, is that a mindset of abundance or is it a mindset of scarcity, right? Because there's only so much you can accomplish by yourself. You're limited to what you can do yourself. But as you put these gifts together, especially in a community, wow, it's limitless. Yahweh's potential with us is limitless. The whole is worth more than individual pieces. This is a kingdom mindset, bearing fruit created in synergy, not competition. To do this, you must train your mind to be sensitive and have consideration and empathy toward others and to be content and secure in their own abilities and gifts from Yahweh's Spirit. So the reason why, if I'm a guitar player, and someone else comes to the guitar play, the reason why I'm jealous is it's my own insecurity. Because I'm not secure in my gifts, and I'm afraid maybe he'll be better than me. You know what? That would be the best thing in the world. Because if he's better than me, I can learn from him. How am I ever going to get better if somebody's in there? I say this with leadership, right? If you're in leadership, and the person you're learning from is only a 5 out of 10 out of a leader, you know what that means? That means the best you're ever going to learn is a 4. Because you're never going to be above a person who's teaching you. How can you learn more than you're learning? So you don't want to be learning under somebody that's only a 5 because the best you can be a 4. You want to be learning of someone who's a 9 or a 10 because you want to get to that ability. So I don't want to have the mindset of scarcity that if somebody comes in and they can do what I'm doing, that I'm going to be fearful of them. I want to be there because I want to learn from them. I remember when I first started the Bible school in Israel many years ago. And the Return to the Land program and all those things that I was doing, you know, with the Ephraimites. And somebody came up to me and they were all upset. They're like, hold on, there's somebody out there and he's trying to do what you're doing. And I said, you ever read that story with Moses, you know, with the 70? And Moses said, I wish that everybody was like this. Because that's the same way I wish. You know, if it was about me, maybe I would get jealous. It's about Yahweh. So the more people doing it, that only reconfirms my mind that it's the right thing. If I'm the only one doing it, maybe it's not the right thing, right? So I would wish everybody would be bringing people there. And I said, but by the way, another reason I'm not worried is because I know nobody can do what I'm doing there. You know? There was a lot of pastors. I was the only one that I knew, a pastor with knowing the truth that was living there for 20 years. So nobody else did that. Nobody else had the connections, and nobody else gave the mind that Yahweh gave me in putting these things together. So why on earth would I be worried for somebody else? And if they had something else that I didn't have, then I want to meet them. I want to know that person. That's why when we went to our school, we would bring in teachers from everywhere. And now the Prime Minister of Israel, you know who he is now, right? The Prime Minister? He was the teacher at our school. Naftali Bennett. He taught at our Bible school. Knew him very well. He was the head of the Yesher Council. So, amazing, you know? So we don't have to fear this. Like I said, it's a kingdom of abundance, and you have to humble yourself to realize you're limited. And if I don't realize my limitations and want people in that have better limitations than me, how am I ever going to learn? How am I ever going to get more abundance to help people get more abundance? And this is all, this is the foundation of the win-win. Because if you don't get this mindset with win-win, you're never going to do it. It's not a slogan. It's not a catchphrase. It's a way that you have to do every single thing in your life that you have to go by automatically without even thinking about it. When something comes up or something you're thinking about doing, if it's not win-win on both sides, it's just not. That's not going to work. And a lot of times when we're the winner and someone else is losing, we don't want to think about it. We don't want to think, well, maybe that's not fair. I remember one time I was in a supermarket in Israel, and the lady overpaid me. I think it was 50 shekels or something. It might have been like $12. And, you know, they're going really fast. So I said, ma'am. And then she says, well, I said, you made a mistake. And she got real offended.
Says, look, I didn't make a mistake.
I said, no, you overpaid me here. And she got really quiet. And she just said, thank you. Nobody's ever done that before. Because you see, that would be win-lose. Because I get this 50 extra shekels, but you know what? She's probably got to pay that at the end of her shift. So what good is that? You know, that's not win-win. It's win-lose. And the key is, in the kingdom, it's always win-win. It doesn't have to be win-lose. And sometimes it's even lose-lose. Sometimes nobody wins. Like with this virus stuff, it's lose-lose. Everybody's losing, nobody's going to win who's taking that vaccine. But we have to make sure that we're living in that kingdom mentality where everything is a win-win mentality. And that's what brings bearing fruit. It brings synergy. And there's so much more, like I said, for a community. There's no other way the community can survive unless it's win-win. Be insensitive, have consideration, empathy towards others, and be content and secure in our own abilities and gifts from Yahweh's Spirit. Again, think with the end in mind. All of these things, these points we're going over, they all overlap with each other. Think with the end in mind, and all fruit born in any given project is collectively gathered by everyone working together for the same common goal. Self and selfish ambition and competition has to go, and our focus has to be on the collective effort that we gain together. And that's why it says, one person sowed and another person reaped, and I reaped what he sowed. You know why? Because it's collective. It's all for the kingdom. We're all working on the same goal. You know? So that's a good thing. It's a good thing. We're working together. He's reaping, he's sowing, and I'm reaping. Like I said, every situation in the community has to be this way. It's the only way a community will do this. And I'll give you an example. We had a situation a while ago. They were having a problem in Ethiopia where they had a rule that people that were working off of the kibbutz had to give 60% of their salary to the kibbutz. And this went on for a while. And then people were leaving the kibbutz. They said they didn't want to stay there anymore. And then they're contacting me and they're saying, we can't survive without those people's salary because there's not enough money that we're producing. So I'm saying something's going on here. So I talked to the people that are leaving and they said, you know, we have parents we have to pay for. We have taxes. We can't afford this. If we're giving 60% of our money to the kibbutz, then it's not working out. So that's not a win-win situation. So I said, okay, what do you think you should be giving? And I forget if they said 20%, 30%. Maybe it was 20%. And then I asked the other people, well, you know, 60% is kind of high. You know, we're not the federal government here. You know, what do you think? And they said, well, maybe 40%. So they said 20, they said 40, they came to agreement at 30%. At 30%, do you think that's fair? Yeah, I think that's fair. You know why? Because even though you're working outside the community and bringing in money, if those people in the community weren't doing all the work in the community for free, you couldn't work outside. Somebody's got to farm. Somebody's got to get the water. Somebody's got to get the milk, right? So you can't do this. You can't work outside and make that money without them. Yeah, you know, you're right. And your people inside, you need some money, you've got to buy your grain, you've got to buy this. So if they're not bringing in money from the outside, you can't survive on the inside. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, 30% isn't that bad. Yeah, actually, it's pretty good. Let's shake hands on it. Win-win, everybody's happy. And then there's always a way to do that. You know, that's what negotiations are about. It's got to be win-win. Both people have to feel worth. Both people have to feel like they're getting something out of it. But there can't be a win-win. Sometimes it's just people's personality. They don't mind losing. You know, to keep peace, I'll lose. I don't mind. And that's not good either. Because are you helping the other person? And I'll tell you, there's times that I will fight for an injustice, not because I want the money back, because I want those people to know you're not going to get away with this. Doesn't matter if it's one penny or it doesn't matter if it's $1,000. If you did something wrong, or you're selling food that's tainted or something, I don't want you to do it to somebody else. So I will fight for that. So you see, you're not going to get away with this. You know? That's my responsibility, so you don't do it to the next person. Because some people are just willing to do it. They don't mind losing. But that's not good, because then you're not loving your brother. You're teaching them that they can take advantage of somebody else and they can get away with it and they'll do it another time. It's got to be win-win. It's got to be where both sides are satisfied and both sides are winning from it. And there was a person that said, you know, you can come to a seminar like this and it all sounds good when we're talking. And then they came out and said, but come on, in a real world, this doesn't work because other people don't look at it as win-win, right? So we're going to be the win-win people, right? We're going to be the honest people. And the other side, they're just going to take advantage. So this person was in real estate, and they thought they would try this technique, right? Win-win. And they go to their meeting, and instead of, you know, because when you negotiate, you never want to give the first price you give isn't the one you really mean, right? Because you need a starting point. So let's say something is $100,000 a house, and I want to buy it, and I'm willing to pay 80. I'm not going to start at 80 because they'll counter me at 90. You know, I'll start maybe at 60 or 70, whatever. It depends on the market. So this person says, but no, let's be honest about it. Let's not play games. Let's go win-win. And he went in, put all his cards on the table, and he got fleeced. And he said, you see, this doesn't work. It's like you're listening. The world isn't like this. They're going to take advantage of me. What did you just say? They took advantage of me. What did you say? They took advantage of me. So it wasn't win-win. It was lose-win. It's not idealistic. Because you know what? There's times where you just walk away. I can be honest, and I can go for win-win. And at the end of the day, if it's not going to work, I shake your hand and say, you know something? You know what win-win is? We don't do a deal. You don't have to do it. It doesn't always have to be that way. So it's not idealistic. It's reality. It's a reality you have to live in all the time. It doesn't mean you can't negotiate, of course. But what I'm saying is the end of that negotiation has to be win-win. You know? So you can't think, well, if I'm honest, I'm going to get fleeced. Then it's not win-win. That's not a win-win situation. It's got to always be win-win. Because you know what? If this isn't one of your core values, and this is something you're willing to compromise with, like anything else, you compromise once, you'll compromise again. You have to make everything win-win. It's got to be something where you will just not allow, number one, to take advantage of somebody else, where you're winning at somebody else's expense, and somebody shouldn't win at your expense. Doesn't mean you can't give to people, or does it mean that you can't be taking advantage of, because that does not help the other person. It's not a win-win situation. It's not a kingdom principle. But like I said, sometimes win-win is simply having to walk away. No deal is better than a bad deal. In the congregation, years ago, we would have it where we were a real close congregation, and we decided that if something came up that somebody wanted to do, they had an idea, it could be anything, you know. Hey, as a congregation, to raise some money, why don't we sell pomegranates? Unless everybody was in agreement, we would just shell it. You know, if you want to do it privately, that's okay. But if we're going to do it as a congregation, either everybody is on board, or we shell it, because we want win-win. We don't want division. That's why, if you remember, when last year, remember when we were going over the Qumran sect? And what was one of the requirements to join Qumran? Everybody had to accept you. So there's 450 people in that community. If a new person came in and 449 said, yes, we want them, but one person said, no, he didn't come. Because you don't want division in your community. It's that simple. And it may start with those two people, but believe me, it won't stop there. If there's division in the camp, it's human nature. You start to take sides, and the next thing you know, the whole community is falling apart. So it's got to be that way. Either everybody agrees to something, you know, and of course we're talking with projects, we're not talking with doctrine. You know, doctrine, there's no debate, but that's coming from Yahweh or something different. But like I said, competition is of the devil. It should never be in a community in any form whatsoever. You know, we can play sports without having to keep score. We don't have to have a winner and a loser because that's not a win-win mentality. You can just combine scores together like we said. And competition against yourself, if you're a runner, you know, maybe you're running a mile, 6.5 minutes, and you want to get down to 6, that's great. you should always be doing competition to better yourself, but not against other people. We're one body, and we're not to pridefully compete to better ourselves at another person's expense. It's just not a kingdom principle. Romans 3 and verse 23. Romans 3 and verse 23. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of Yahweh, being justified freely by his grace through the redemption of Messiah Yeshua, whom Yahweh set forth as a sacrifice of atonement through faith in his blood, as a demonstration of his righteousness toward the remission of our sins that are past in the forbearance of Elohim, for a demonstration of his righteousness in the present time, for his being just and justifying the one that is of the faith of Yeshua. I was going over this just on Yom Kippur. And then verse 27 says, so then where is the boasting? It is not there. So that's the other thing that we think of. There's no boasting because any gift we have is from Yahweh. You know? And he could have just as easily given it to somebody else. So I can sit here and I can be Mozart on the piano. But it's only because Yahweh put that in my fingers and not somebody else's. And that's why everything we do to the glory of Yahweh. Because whatever we have, we want to use to his glory to help somebody else, not for just ourselves. Because it's not a win-win mentality. And the hardest part of living in community is that it doesn't become so normal that people forget to practice the little things that make a community work. You know, like they say, familiarity breeds contempt. And that's the biggest thing you have to watch for in a community, that you're not living together and you're taking for granted the respect that comes, please and thank yous. You know, I used to see this sometimes early on at the Bible school or longer schools that we had. You know, sometimes people get together at night, they're having fun, that's good, but joking and ribbing at somebody's expense, you know, I would expect that from you, making these things. There's no place for that, you know. And that's not win-win. It's not win-win of putting someone else down to get a lift from somewhere. So we want to make sure, like I said, one of the hardest things of living in a community is that it doesn't become so normal, because whatever you're focused on becomes most real, and when you're living together, very easily it could happen that way. We always want to be thinking about that. Must stay committed to personal prayer and Bible study daily. Must focus on change and continually work on being a better believer for the growth of the community. This is why one of the things I love in the community setting is the daily devotion. You know, you get up, each of us have to do our own private prayer and study, but to come together for a group, and it doesn't have to be long, you know. We used to do in Israel, we used to do it for just 15, 20 minutes. And each man would take an opportunity to, he could do whatever he wanted to. It could be a scripture, it could be a song, it could be a little lesson, it could be anything. It could even just be a life story. But we would just start the day in prayer, and then one of the men would do a little lesson to get the day started with a good principle from something. And it was awesome. I really, really liked doing that. Then also, in a community, you need avenues for people to be able to grow. You know, men's club, ladies' club, you know, things like that. You have to have that. You have to have it. If you're going to grow, you continuously have to have these avenues. Now, I'll tell you something. At the Bible school, I never had it on the official schedule for the Spokesman's Club, but we did it a lot of times. Most of the times we did it, and the men loved it. Just the camaraderie you get, same with the women. You know, I mean, it's great we're one body and, you know, we're diversified, we're here together. But there's something special when you get a room full of women or you get a room full of men, and then, you know, you can open up about things that you wouldn't open up in a, you know, a mixed setting. And everybody loved it. And then what we'd have is the end of the year, we'd have the ladies' night, where the ladies get to come and hear the final speeches and everything. And we would prepare and cook for the women. And it was nice. It was really, really nice. But you need these kind of things. Because there's certain things that women can only work on together as women. you know, topics, because they're women. There's things that you go through that we don't go through as men. It's the other way around. There's topics we would bring up as men that you might not bring up, you know, with the ladies together. So it's important in a community that we're doing this. Committees for communal outreach, helping widows and those in need. Personal goals need to be written down and accomplished regularly. So you need to have all this. You know, the bigger the kibbutz, like our kibbutz in Ethiopia that has 700 people, 800 people, it's like a city. And you have to have all kinds of committees, education committee, finance committee, you know, you name it, because everybody and everything needs to be cared for. This is what community is all about. It teaches us you can't have a community without a win-win mentality. Judicial order is voluntary and reciprocal. It's win-win. So people that are against judicial order, they simply don't understand kingdom concepts. Because if they think judicial order is, I'm in charge, or he's under me, that's not judicial order. Judicial order is just Yahweh has an order and a structure, and of course there has to be leadership, but he wants to be greatest among you, let him be your servant, right? You don't see that in the world. And it's voluntary and reciprocal. So the people are voluntarily submitting to the leadership, and their leadership is doing the same back. That's the kingdom mentality. And anyone that doesn't understand that, you have to try to explain it to them. And if they don't want to understand it, then they're having a win-lose mentality. You know? And like I said, some of the worst dictators I've seen in my life are people that are totally against any kind of leadership or judicial order, but with their wives and their kids, they're like dictators. You know? And I've seen it. I've seen it a lot of times, particularly in Babylon. So, in everything, in our marriage, it's always got to be win-win. With our children, it's got to be win-win. Everything, every situation in life should be that way. And that's what's going to bring peace and harmony. Maturity comes by developing the balance of courage and consideration. Maturity comes by developing the balance of courage and consideration. Because it takes courage to do this, right? You know? So we have to understand this, and that's why I say judicial order is voluntary and reciprocal. It's voluntary and reciprocal. You have to understand it. And you only have the authority that somebody gives you. When I go into somebody's house, even though I'm the elder, unless that person asks me, says, Elder, no, will you say the prayer, will you do this, then I'll do whatever I'm asked to do. And you guys know this from when I go, right, on mission trips. I'm just there to do whatever is asked of me. Even though I'm the senior elder and they respect me, I don't come in. Sometimes they want me to. You know, they come up and this is going on and that's going on. You know, it's like when Yeshua, remember when the two brothers, tell him to give me my money. Who paid me, master, over you? You know, but that's not my job. And that's not judicial order. So you have to understand this. To have a win-win situation, you have to understand what real judicial order is. That every man is the priest of his own family. So you can't go outside of your judicial order, or it's going to be controlling spirit. It's not going to be from Yahweh. So it's important to understand. So let me go over now. We have to work as a team instead of individuals. We've got to get this mindset. And we have to train our children to learn cooperation, not competition, like we said. Learn our children to learn cooperation, not competition. So 4 points to win-win situation. In our character, integrity. If you don't have character and integrity, you're never going to go for win-win. You're always going to go for win-lose. You're always going to want to win at anybody else's expense. So the first thing is character integrity. You have to have, like I said, the abundance mindset. There's enough for everybody. Everything starts with one person, one idea, to build the mindset. Never compromising on your core values to always have a win-win situation. Doesn't matter what the situation is, you don't compromise on your core values, period. Number two is trust level relationship. Trust level relationships. If we don't trust each other in community, how can we ever have a win-win mindset? So this is why leadership is so important, and I've ingrained it in our elders' heads for years. You know, that it can take 20 years to build up, to be a servant of Yahweh, and you can make one stupid move to, you know, disqualify yourself. So it's important to build trust levels and relationships. We had a situation years ago in the Philippines, I don't know if you remember, down in Mindanao, where this was one of the first men in the Sacred Name movements. I'm not sure if he's even alive today, but he was with us in the congregation. And the brethren would come and say, I don't want to tithe to Elder so-and-so because I know he's keeping the money for himself. Then we find out that the brethren donated all this money to build a house of worship on this man's property, and then he sold the property and kept all the money. So, again, when you're looking now as a community, how can there ever be a trust level in that kind of situation? How can you ever have judicial order? You know? And that's another thing that really, really burns my blood, because I've only seen judicial order usually the other way. I've seen people that don't want to follow leadership and people that have too much problem. And that's why it so much burns me when I see brethren being taken advantage of because he's the elder, you know, and they don't want to talk against the elder or they don't want to say nothing, so they sit there in a lose-win situation for years. For years. Like I said, I mean, I'm not a violent person, but that's really where I want to choke somebody when I see that, because everybody's getting hurt and they're putting up with it. And we see it happening. You know, you guys see it, right? In the third world. You see it. You see it where there's leaders and elders that take advantage of the people, they're taking the money, and you can't have that. So again, if we are going to have win-win situations beside the character and the integrity, you have to have trust levels. It all comes down to relationship. Because if you have enough spiritual bankroll, if you have enough where people trust you, then they're going to give you the benefit of the doubt with things, you know? You're not going to be looking to think, oh, this guy's doing this wrong, this guy's doing this wrong, because they know they trust you. But if you can't be, like it said in Scripture, if you can't be faithful in the littlest of things, how are you even going to be faithful in the most? So a community will never work that way. It'll never work. And the problem we have is that we expanded so fast that many of the congregations weren't congregations that I personally started. Because the ones I started, someone wouldn't get ordained like that. If they did get ordained and it was found out, they're going to be gone. They're not going to hang around like that. So sometimes, you know, you go here, you get 20 congregations that are joining us, and you wonder, he's the elder? This guy? You know, how on earth did he ever get to be the elder? And you see, he doesn't know the doctrine, he doesn't have any character, and he's a thief. You know, on top of it, how on earth did he get to be your elder? And then you gotta do damage control. But you have to have this. If there is no trust level, and that's why I say it's not enough to just take one for the team. It's not enough to be quiet, because it'll be lose-win until the point where you can't take it anymore, where there's nothing left to take. You know? So there's got to be, it's extremely important that there's trust level relationship. Number three. Any agreement made in a community, agreements must be win-win. When I say agreements, most communities, I suggest, and most of them have done it, that they have like a constitution. You know, they have things that they believe in, you know, or principles that they want to go by. And an agreement, like I said, whether it's the agreement of people that are working outside, the community needs to bring money in, it's got to be win-win. You can't have agreements that are not a win-win situation. Because what happens is, you start with the kibbutz, and there's an agreement that is not satisfactory, and nobody says nothing, because they don't want to seem like they're the complainer. But like I said, within a matter of months, it's ready to split. Because this can't be sustained. People can't be giving 60% of their salary or there's nothing left for their family. So agreements have to be always made on a win-win basis. And number four, systems and processes also have to be win-win. talking about the way committees are set up should never be done with nepotism. You know, we see this thing. I'll get an email from somebody and they'll say, you know, that, oh, we're having a problem here in the congregation because the man that's the elder got rid of all the elders, and it's only his brothers and his brother-in-laws that are in all the committees, you know. Or, you know, he said, we're buying the grain, his brother-in-law's in charge of this, and he owns it, and he's selling it for three times the amount of money that it should be, something like that. So we have to make sure that the systems and the processes in the community are always win-win. There can't be nepotism, jealousy, or strife. And the bottom line is, who should be in charge of these committees? The ones that have the best qualifications for it. You know? You shouldn't have to put somebody in a committee simply because of whatever reason. It should be who's got qualified. It's that simple. The ones who have the best qualifications can do it. We have to truly incorporate the commands of love our neighbors ourselves. Our mind has to work on never accepting an outcome unless it benefits everyone. Win-win has to be a mindset and win-life. And like I said, this one thing can help you in every relationship in your life, no matter what it is. Because your mind will always figure out how to make it win-win. And you will not accept anything less, even if you're the one benefiting. Because you know, if you're benefiting and someone else is lost, then that's not a kingdom principle. So this, more than anything, I think, is really a point that makes or breaks a community. Because other things can be worked out if you have the win-win mentality. Number five. Before being understood. And like I said, I deal with a lot of things. Two people will come to me. One will say black. One will say white. Two brown. And it happens more and more and more. And what's really sad to me is, how can two people with the spirit of Yahweh both say something totally opposite? And you know what it is a lot of times? Because people want to be understood before they understand. This is so important. Look to understand before being understood. And people are arguing when they don't even know what the other person's point is. They don't even know what they're arguing about. They don't even know what they're standing for. And sometimes, I've had this happen a lot of times with marriages, they're arguing and they're saying the same thing. They're actually arguing and they're both saying the same exact thing, but they won't stop long enough to just listen to the other person that's agreeing with them. Can you imagine? It's such a basic thing. Love your neighbor as yourself, right? Just simply look to understand before being understood. Think about it. Every teacher has to understand the needs of his students before he can teach. What I'm teaching today, would I just teach to anybody? Of course not. Would I teach any brethren? No. If you were not an advanced group of brethren, I'd be teaching something totally different. So you have to know, as a teacher, you have to know who you're teaching to, or what's the point of teaching it. The same thing with a lawyer, right? If you have a lawyer in a lawsuit, he doesn't just walk into the court and start defending you. He has to do discovery. He's got to find out what the problem is before he can help you in that case. And the same with any doctor. Do you walk into the doctor's office and he just hands you a pill? And it's like, take it, go ahead. Yep. Okay, what now? What's wrong with you? Of course not. The doctor has the doctor has to understand the problem or analyze the problem before he can get a cure. Right? And what is he doing? Looking to understand before being understood. So that's what the doctor's doing. He's simply asking you, well, tell me what your problem is. Where does it hurt? How long have you had this for? Do you have other symptoms? And most of the time, good doctors, without even x-rays or MRIs or this and that, if they know what they're doing, they can know 99% what they need to give you beforehand because they're asking you. And that's the problem. Too many times, people are reversing it. They want to be understood before seeking to understand. It's so foundational, but I'm telling you, it's another principle that can change your life. Because if we're dealing here in development of relationships, like I said this morning. You know, everything is about relationships with people. That's what's going to make people happy in life. And if you really want to have a relationship, you have to seek understanding before being understood. Like I said, every good teacher understands the needs of the students before he can teach. Every lawyer must do discovery before he can try a case. And every doctor must understand the problem before prescribing the cure. How do we do this? We need to master the art of listening. You know the old adage why Yahweh gave us 2 ears in our mouth? Because we should be listening twice as much as we're speaking. I have a cousin who loved listening. Most problems arise because one or both parties are not listening to the concerns of the other side. True listening helps you to understand where the other person is coming from and what they need to solve the issue. So by listening, it doesn't mean you're agreeing with what the person's saying. You're simply listening to understand why he's saying it. And if you're going to be like a doctor, if you have an answer or a cure to give him, you have to know what his problem is before you can tell him. And that's the problem, that interrupting. Two words come out, and it's on the same lane. You never get to hear what the other person actually says. How can you give advice if you haven't heard what the problem is? We may think we know the problem, but we must understand it from how the other person is being affected. Because the same thing might affect people 10 different ways. So you just can't think how it affects you. You have to think how other people. And you know, when we used to keep the Feast in Israel, this would happen all the time. But someone would come up to me and they'd say, oh, what are we doing tomorrow? Oh, tomorrow we're going to go to the Mount of Olives. Ah, there again? I already would have been there. I've been there 3 other times. I'm like, well, you know, there's 40 people here this year that have never seen it before. So, you know, Yahweh didn't write Leviticus 23 just for you. But people don't think that way. They're not thinking of how that other person would feel. They're just thinking of what's best for them. And many times the issue could be solved because what each party wants is really not being disputed a lot of time. But the parties simply fail to listen to each other and the problem doesn't get solved. Sometimes I'll sit there for 2 hours with 2 people there, and I don't even know what they're talking about. I don't even know what their argument is. Because you never got to that. You're just yelling at each other the whole time. You know, and you didn't even get to that point yet that you even know why you're sitting there. This is what Matthew 18 is all about, right? The Matthew 18 process. And that's why you go to the person directly. And that's why if the person doesn't listen, then you bring witnesses. This is what the Matthew 18 process is all about. And like I said this morning, the quality of your life is in the questions that we ask. Ask better questions, get better answers. But we must listen to what is being said for us to apply it properly. We must have the attitude that every person, no matter who they are, has value. Because that's another thing sometimes. People don't want to listen, like somehow they get frustrated with each other. But we have to think every single person has value. There's a saying, I forget who did it, a poet or something said it many, many moons ago, but it goes, every hand is my teacher that I may learn from him, right? So you can learn something from everybody, even if it's a bad example, like in the Bible, like King Saul, right? We're learning from him, maybe by his bad example, but we're still learning. So we want to make sure that our attitude is that we're giving everybody value. So, I'm going to go over 5 ways to listen. These are basically the 5 ways we listen, not 5 ways to listen, but the 5 ways that people listen. The first way, ignoring, not really listening at all. The first way to listen is not to listen. Just basically ignoring. And you see that happen sometimes. You can see it happening maybe at a supermarket where you're trying to get the manager something, and you try to explain to him what happened, and they're just not listening to you whatsoever. You know, and then when they're done, they give you an answer, you're like, huh? You didn't hear a word I had to say. So the first thing, ways to listen, is just ignoring, not really listen. The second way to listen is to pretend to listen, but the person is just thinking about their response. And you can tell when somebody's doing this, right? When they're kind of just like shaking their head. You're just shaking your head, waiting to stop. And the minute you stop, they're already telling. Because in their mind, they're not even listening. They're just thinking of their response to you. They don't even have a listening. I've had this happen dealing with people with different things that Yeshua didn't pre-exist. And they'll ask me, can you tell me this? I'm giving them 40 scriptures. They're not listening to a word I say. Because the first answer out of their mouth is nothing of what I said. It's just something else. You know, so that's the second way. Pretend to listen, but just thinking about your response. Number three is selective listening. You hear what you want to hear. You know, maybe two people there, right? Could even be marriage counseling. And the one person says, I really think that you do great at this. You fix the car really good, and I appreciate that you're paying the bills. But, you know, the drinking at night and these other things, it's got to stop. And then they'll start. You see, you said I do good with the car. You said I do good with the car. So it's selective listening. They hear what they want to hear. And I find it very interesting. Because I have this sometimes with sermons. You know, like I give a sermon and somebody will come up to me afterwards and say, oh, that was a great sermon. I'll say, oh, you know, thank you. And then they'll tell me something in the sermon that I never said. You know, they're applying it toward something in their life, which is great, but it's something that, you know, I'm like, oh, okay, you know, that's what you got out of it. We had the same sermon, we had the same room. So it's selective listening. People hear what they want to hear. And sometimes people just want to be right. So they're just looking for that. And that's why I tell people sometimes, when we're dealing in certain situations, you know, and a person will be giving a response, and the response is like very broad and other things, and I say, don't do this. Just deal directly with what was said to you. Because you know what's going to happen? The person that does number three, what they're going to do is, you're going to respond to what they said, and you're going to try to explain it in a broader sense, and then they're going to start responding on your, not what you said, but on your broader things that you said. And then, like I said, before you know it, you're arguing about things that you don't even know. So stick to the main point. Just stick to the point of it. Because if people have selective listening, it's never going to happen. Number four is attentive listening. Well, you're really listening. You really want to hear what's being said. It's a serious listening to what's being said. Attentive listening. Which is good. But the best one is number five, the last one. Emphatic listening. Emphatic listening. Emphatic listening is you're literally trying to get into the head of the person who's talking. You're not thinking about what advice you're going to give. You're not thinking about what to say. You're literally just trying to feel what this person is feeling and what they're going through. You're trying to get into the head and the heart of the person, understanding why they're saying what they're saying. And the key to listening is with the eyes and the heart and the body language. You know, words is only 20%. Of what we say, the communications with the words, 80% is with our body language and our emphatic speaking with it. So you're listening, you're literally watching the person and you're trying to understand it into the eyes and the heart, the head and the heart of the person who's speaking. Only asking questions to truly understand the feelings of the one speaking, to try to understand his feelings better. Is why you're asking questions. So like I said, the key to happiness in life is the quality of relationships. It's not money, it's not things. You know, it's not knowing how many scriptures you can memorize, but it's in the quality of our relationships, and that's based on our ability to listen. If you don't have the ability to listen, your relationships are going to be real bad. And in work, it's essential because you probably won't hold a job down if you're not able to listen. So, doctor, you have to analyze the problem before getting a cure. And this is a problem a lot of times with our children. that what we're trying to do is we're trying to show them where they're wrong before we understand why they believe that way. So what you were saying to me is very good for part two, but in part one, you got to understand what's going on. You got to understand why that person feels that way. You got to understand what is making it, even if he's totally wrong. A lot of times you got to look at not the action, but you got to find out why is that person feeling that action. And particularly with kids, because what happens with kids, they don't want to open up. They don't want to open up why they feel that way. And they don't feel like they're going to be heard. So it's not that you're going to agree with what they're doing. And it's not that you're going to not give them solutions, what you think. But the first thing is, you have to understand their heart. You've got to get in there. You have to understand. So in a situation like this, the things to be asking, like, well, tell me, is this something that just came up, or is it something you're feeling a long time? Well, I've been feeling this way for a long time. And tell me exactly why. Why you're feeling this way. Well, at church, I feel like nobody ever talks to me. I feel like I'm not even there. They don't even bother with me. And are there other reasons? You know, are there other things that are also making you feel this way? Like, you're trying to get into that heart and mind of the person to understand why you're feeling that way. Because usually, their response, like the response of quitting, is just a cry out. Just like suicide. They say most people that try to commit suicide, you don't try to commit suicide. You do it or you don't. And if you slit your wrist straight down, you can kill yourself. If you cut yourself across, you're probably not going to die. But most people that do it, they're not trying to kill themselves. They're crying out. They want help. And that's what they're looking for. And this is the point with listening. And again, there is a point where you want to give. And you know, there's times, like I said, I counsel hundreds of people a year. And you don't know how many times that somebody, sometimes they'll even like get in touch with my head. So-and-so's got to get in touch with me. It's life or death. Blah, blah, blah. And I'm talking to the person that, you know, something, they don't even ask me one question. I barely got a hold of them. And I just listened for an hour, and they said, wow, thank you, Amanda. It's so good I talked to you. I'm thinking, okay, if that works, that's great. They just wanted someone that would listen. You know, somebody that would listen to them, that they felt that was listening to them. Not always do people want advice. Sometimes they do. And when they want it, you give it. But sometimes they just want to feel like they're being understood. They want to feel like they're being heard. So like I said, think about this. Because it's really powerful. You know, because it's the basis for relationships with everybody. You know, to be understood before you're looking to be, to understand rather, before you're looking to be understood. Just to understand where that person's coming from. And one of the things is, why I like that better, like if I gotta go to Greg, I gotta talk with Greg. And, okay, Greg, me and you are gonna talk this out. By allowing him to talk to me first and understanding him, it might change everything I was gonna say to him. It might change absolutely everything I'm gonna say. And I might save myself from saying some things that I would have said that now I would come on, oh, now I understand. Mm-hmm. You know. There was one time where years ago, Church of God was very strict with wearing suits and ties. And I was working with a lawnmower, and my arm went on the muffler of the lawnmower, and literally my skin burned off. So when I came into services, I was wearing a leather jacket, but I wasn't wearing a suit jacket. And I saw the elder in the bathroom, and he said, "Is that so-and-so, so-and-so?" And the first thing he says to me, "Oh, I see you're not wearing a jacket." I said, "Well, yeah, actually, I'm sorry, but, you know, I burned my arm." And he didn't say nothing, he just walked out. And I'm thinking, he didn't even ask me if I was okay. I had serious burn, you know. He didn't say nothing about that. And there was one elder there, the one guy I was telling you about, that I really admired. But I always forget, because one thing I wanted to say to him before leaving, I wanted to say, "Mr. So-and-so, I really admire you as a leader. You have a lot of really good talents. You taught me a lot. and in certain ways I really try to aspire to you, but the one thing I have to say is I never felt love from you. As a leader, I just never felt love, you know? And because I felt maybe it would help them. He wasn't a bad person, you know? And sometimes by listening, by understanding, that's what helps us. And we got to get to that point because we don't want to just be number four, attentive listening. That's good, to really, really listen. We want to be emphatic listening. We want to see from the heart, why is this person doing what they're doing? What is the reason behind it? And as bad as it might be, you know, because what happens is, if we come too quick with the answer, even if it's the right answer, in that person's mind, it becomes confrontational now. Oh, this, oh, you tell me that before. And it might not, in the end, it might not help anyone. You know, it depends on, the relationships again, like we talked about before. You know, when we're dealing with trust levels in relationships, the higher the trust level, the more, you know, investment you have in that person that they might listen, the less the trust level, it's going to take time. But it's got to start somewhere. You know, it's got to start somewhere. So this is extremely important, and I'll leave on this point with one other thing to say. Somebody said one time, you know, I just don't understand my son. He doesn't listen to me at all. Can you say that again? I just don't understand my son. He just doesn't listen to me at all. Say that one more time. I don't understand my son. He just doesn't listen to me. I thought to understand somebody, you listen to them. Right? Isn't that a contradiction? I don't understand my son, he won't listen to me. That would mean he doesn't understand you. If I want to understand my son, then I should listen to him, not him listen to me. And this is why. This is why, like I said, relationships, we hit this point. And it really, like I said, as the elder and pastor, there's nothing that frustrates me more to see brethren like this that can't sit down, and especially when it's leaders that are like at each other's throats, you know? And I say to myself, and I've even said this to a leader, you know, you can keep the Sabbath perfect, you can do all these other things. This is crazy. This is the basis of what our whole calling is about, loving each other, right? That's the basis of it. So all these other things, we're like Pharisees then, if we can't do the basic thing. And it starts with listening. You know, it's a lost art, because in the day-to-day, one of the problems is that Satan has given us so much clutter in our life. And I think I was telling Ryan recently, one of my lawyers is a good friend of mine in Israel. I really like the guy, he's helping a lot. But wow, I feel so bad for this guy. He's a young guy, he's probably in his mid-40s. Really, really nice guy. His father-in-law was the secretary of prime minister before. And to go and see him, it's like, it takes a miracle, you know? I mean, I could always go in there, but to actually have him listening, he has 3 or 4 phones going on at one time. He's always on the phone thinking, who can live this way? How can he hear anything you have to say? I say, you know, when you have too much clutter in your life, even if you're a good person with good intentions, how can you listen? You got to be able to take that clutter out. Number 6, synergizing. Synergizing, the sum is worth more than the individual pieces. We talked about this before. When going from win-win, listening to each other, you can synergize something better than you could have done it. So I love this aspect, because whenever I'm doing a project, or we're doing something with the elders, like now we're working on these kibbutzes and doing things. You know, I got ideas, and I'm like a planner. I am an ideas man, but I'm not always the detailed person. So, you know, you come together, and you're going over things, and somebody that will have maybe more intellect or certain things will be like, hey, yeah, we can do that, we can do it this way. And as you brainstorm together, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 people, you come up with a synergy that is way more than could have ever been done on your own. You know, like we said, the sum is worth more than the individual pieces. So, if you look at a compromising situation. In a compromising situation, 1 + 1. Equals 1.5. And I've had that too. When I'm working with people where there's not that synergy, and you're like, oh, I wish I did this on my own. Because it's actually taking away from it. So in a compromising situation, 1 + 1 can equal 1.5. In a negative synergy, if you have negative synergy, one plus one can equal 1/2. You can actually lose if there's negative synergy there. But if you have positive synergy, 1 + 1 can equal 3, 6, 16, 600. You don't know. You know, you just don't know. When there's positive synergy, that's the kingdom principle of abundance, right? There's no limit to it. So this is why it's important. This is why Yahweh made us as a family and as a congregation. We're not islands to work alone. We need to work together. Because as we work together, 1 + 1 can equal anything. Community living is based on the principle of synergy, working together to multiply our efforts. We have to value diversity and differences. You have to value diversity and differences. This is what gives strength to the community, right? As long as we all have the same common goal. And when you outsource something, you outsource it to somebody who can do it. And I always say this, you know, when you're talking about time management. If somebody can do something 80% as good as you can do it, outsource it. And that way you can be doing something that, you know, that you master it. But once you outsource it, let the person do it. You can't micromanage. You know, there's no sense, there's no synergy that's going to come from micromanaging. We have to value diversity and differences. So somebody may have done it different. Like I might, maybe I give the, outsource to somebody to decorate this room tomorrow for the conference. And you come in and decorate a certain way and I say, oh, I don't think I would have did it that way. Well, you know, often I should have did it myself. Is there anything wrong with it? No. It's just I kind of like something different. Well, I should have did it myself. But once you outsource, let the person do it. That's the whole point of it. You know? We have to embrace diversity. That people can do something differently. Have to value diversity and differences. It gives strength to the community. As long as there's a common spirit, purpose, and goal. You don't want something that is against a kingdom principle. But how could the community prosper if everybody only had the same gift that I had? Right? So we have to learn that. And that's the whole point of synergy. 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 5. 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 5. It says, who then is Paul and who is Apollos, but ministers through whom you believe, and each one is gifted in Yahweh as Yahweh gave him. I planted, Apollos watered, but Elohim produced the increase. So that neither he who plants nor he who waters deserves the credit, but Elohim gives the increase. Thus the planter and the waterer are equal, and each one will receive his own reward according to his own labor. For we labor together with Elohim, and you are Elohim's work, and you are a building of Elohim. Right? So one might dig up the dirt, one might plow, one might sow the seed, one might water, but at the end Yahweh gives the increase. We're all working toward the same goal of the kingdom. We all have diversity in gifts, like it talks about in 1 Corinthians 12, and that's what's going to bring more fruit for the kingdom. So we have to look to embrace that. Only lasting accomplishments are collective for the kingdom. And the last point This point, number seven, is called sharpen the saw. Sharpen the saw. We need to practice these things. Like I said, this is only a seminar that you learn the book and you close the book until next year. It doesn't mean anything. You know, I always say that when people go, I say, that's a really good sermon you gave. I say, it's only good if you apply it. You know, that's the only thing. So we have to sharpen the saw. Busy, being busy isn't necessarily being productive. We have to streamline our life. We have to learn better processes. We have to sharpen the saw. So as you learn these things, as you go along, you should be doing them better. And that, it doesn't matter what it is. Everything you do in your life should be streamlined and done better. You know, you should be able to do it more efficiently, more effectively. You know, whether that's changing the oil on the car, you know, or cleaning the gutters of your house. We're always thinking of being more efficient, more effective. There was a guy one time who's working really hard there, and he's cutting a tree. Big, big tree out there. He's soaring and soaring. So, say, hey, how long have you been working? Oh, man, I'm working for 4 hours. And then you look and you see that saw is kind of, you know, bent. And you say to the guy, well, don't you think you sharpen the saw? Can't, too busy. Can't sharpen the saw, too busy. So, but that's our life sometimes, right? Our life sometimes, because it gets into chaos, it gets out of order, we're so busy we don't stop to sharpen the saw. Where we think this guy's working 4 hours, and if he would have sharpened the saw, he would have been done in 2. But he's so busy soaring, can't sharpen the saw. So sharpening a saw is extremely important. You know? Most successful people in the world, the most people, financial people, successful people, you would think, well, hey, they made it, wouldn't they? Do you know they meet every year and they brainstorm off each other? They have these meetings. That's why I say men's meetings, ladies' meetings. We constantly have to be sharpening the saw. We constantly, our minds are made that way, you know? And that's why reading, I love reading. I don't read just anything, but like I find these books that I look at like pearls, like jewels, you know, like Ernest Martin's Temple book. Or, you know, the Rabbi Akiva's Messiah, the books that are like really, really good, because you sharpen the saw, you're learning something, you're learning something that you didn't know before, and you're learning from it. So we need to be doing this brainstorming and bettering ourselves with it. Now, what's the opposite of sharpening the saw? We're back to the no active person. You know, what we talked about at the beginning, and not a bad person. They can be smart, they can be diligent, they can be responsible. They just never think about tomorrow. You know? And like I said, when you're telling them about this, it's like, oh no, it'll get better. But they never have a plan for it to get better. And like I said, everything can go great in their life because they can be very talented, making a lot of money, until the bottom falls out. And they lose the job, and then that's it. They don't know what to do next because they never sharpened the saw. They never kept moving. And I'll tell you something. In almost every industry in the world, if you don't sharpen the saw, don't use that person. You know, you look at like even somebody as basic as a mechanic, right? Cars are completely different today. And if that mechanic isn't going and learning the different engines and the different, he's useless. A doctor. Can you imagine a doctor who's not sharpening the saw? As they're coming out with new technologies all the time, and he's giving you a technology from 20 years ago that maybe didn't even work that good then. He just leaves it alone until it breaks. Never mind not even sharpening it, he just keeps going until the thing busts. Many don't think of the future, they just keep sharpening the saw until it breaks. Then they panic with no plan in mind. Like I said, they're not lazy people. They're just not proactive. And that's why when the saw finally breaks and they realize it ain't getting better, then they panic. Because they have a plan. They don't know what to do at that point. Sharpening the saw is the concept of continual learning, always bettering the self, growing in spiritual gifts. The founder of McDonald's, Ray Kroc, who's probably heard of McDonald's, I don't know if you know his name is Ray Kroc, the founder. But when I graduated high school, you have to put a saying, you know, next to your name. And I tried to put the saying from him. And his saying was, as long as you're green, you're growing. As soon as you ripen, you start to rot. For some reason, they wouldn't let me put that in the yearbook. Don't ask me why. They wouldn't let me. So I put, whatever the mind can believe and conceive, the mind can achieve. That was my motto back then. But Ray Kroc, I love that saying, you know why? As long as you're green, you're growing. As soon as you're ripe, you start to rot. Think about that, like a plant on a tree. As long as it's green, right, a piece of fruit, it's growing, like a mango. The minute you pick it, it starts to rot. You know? The minute you pick it, you have a gestation time now. Once you pick that fruit, some of them can be days, some of them can be a week. But the minute you pick it, and you know, an avocado is the only fruit that only starts to ripe when you pick it. So if you left it on the tree, it would never ripe. So as long as you're green, you're growing. As long as you're learning, as long as you're studying, as long as you know you're always, you, then you're green. The minute you think, oh, I've done that. Oh, we've learned that before. Oh, this teaching again? There was a pastor one time, and he was preaching a sermon on unity in the congregation. And then the next week he preached similar, and then the third week. And by the fourth week when he went up there and he preached the same sermon, one of the deacons or something came up to him and they said, you know, Pastor, I don't know if you noticed or not, people maybe he's getting seen out. Did you notice that you preach the same sermon in 4 weeks in a row? He said, how long are you going to do that? He said, until you learn the lesson. Or you learn the lesson. So that's the point of it. We never, until Yeshua's feet touch the Mount of Olives, we haven't gotten to the top of the mountain yet. We always have to be sharpening the saw. So I know in myself, even something like, they consider me like with the Temple Mount, like an expert. I've done television and did interviews and different things. But you want to know something? I read Ernest Martin's book at least once a year. And I will never go on a television program or have an interview if I know without preparing myself. Because I want to sharpen the saw. You know, I want to learn something new. There's things I might learn in that book after the 15th time reading it that I didn't learn the other 14 times. It's the same with the Bible. Every time I read the Bible, it's like I never read it before. There's something new that pops out of there. And we have to feel that way. We always have to be growing. We always have to be going back and sharpening the saw. There was it's the way you become a master at something. You know, is by repetition, by doing it over and over and over again. If you ever heard of a man called John Wooden, anybody ever heard of him? Famous coach from UCLA, one of the, dead now, but was older man, one of the greatest coaches in college history. And you'd have these guys like Michael Jordan coming out of high school and going into the college, and they're the big star, and they're gonna, you know, do this, and they're gonna dunk the ball. And John Wooden would take them and he'd say, okay, stand here, and it's called a chippy, it's like the easiest shot. He said, do 1,000 of them. Or a free throw, you know, another easy shot. Do 1,000 of them. And he said, hey man, come on, I'm the best in the nation. I didn't come here to do that. And he said, when you master that, come back to me. That's the problem today. Everybody thinks they're a master. Every man is my teacher, then you learn from them. And there's too many cooks, you know, in the kitchen. And people aren't masters. And that's why you have all this chaos. Anybody can slap up a website and put anything there, but they're not masters of what they do. They're not masters of what they teach. But everybody wants to get there without putting in the work. You know, and you have to put the work in. You know, can you imagine going to a doctor and you got pain in your side and you never went there before and, you know, you say to the doctor, how long have you been practicing? Today's my first day. Oh, you mean you just got out of school? No. Didn't go to school. I mean, I'm practicing. You know, come on. You've got to sharpen the saw. You have to keep doing this. Three ways, we'll end on this. Three ways to maintain a plan for continual growth and sharpening the saw in your life are number one, physical. Physical, you know, I mean, The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. And when your body's not working as much as you want to, it's very hard. So we need to, if we're going to sharpen the saw, we need to physically try to stay in good shape. Exercise, nutrition, stress management, right? 1 Timothy 4:8 says, bodily exercise is profitable to a little, but righteousness is profitable to all things. So it didn't say bodily exercise is not profitable at all. It's profitable for a little. So we don't want to spend hours and hours and hours a day on physical exercise, but we should spend some. We should spend a little bit. Because like I said, it's very hard to mentally be spiritual if your body's not working. Key to anything in life is consistency. You know, walking daily, cardiovascular exercise. The food you eat is going to affect the quality of your life, and also the length of it, of course. When we're dealing with stress, I believe faith is the greatest way to lower stress. The more faith you have, the less stress you're going to have. Because where does stress come from? Stress comes from the unknown, you know? It doesn't come from having faith in Yahweh. When you have faith in Yahweh, you don't have to worry about it. It comes from the unknown, which comes from not having enough faith. So if the more faith you have, the less stress you will have. Trusting Yahweh for everything. And like I said, we read the book, we win the end. So you have to believe it does. Part of faith is not worrying about the things you can't control, but taking care of the things you can control. And that's where stress comes from. It's the things out of our control that we're worried about. Losing a job, you know, getting kicked out of an apartment, you know, vaccine passports. These are things you can't control, so why worry about it? All the worry in the world doesn't change any of it. What you want to do is put your focus, because whatever you focus on becomes most real, put your focus on what you can control. What you can do about it. Where can you go? You know, okay, dude, I'm not going to be able to buy food soon. Let me get food now. So, part of faith is not worrying about the things you can't control, but taking care of the things in your control. And that will keep your stress in the middle. Because the things you can control will be your focus, and then you're going to feel good. Because you're controlling them. You know, when you're getting them done. And always have in your life and time and meaningful activities. You know, always have your life and your time and meaningful activities. You know, and I'm not against the idea of a vacation. I think if people work hard and they want to take a vacation or take a time off, that's fine. But the reason why I don't like a vacation is because I don't want to ever leave my work. So to me, I don't look at work, hard work is this, and this is leisure time where I'm having fun. I look at my work as my leisure. I love my work. So like, we might do something like when we went to Patmos a couple of years ago. You know, it wasn't a vacation, but it was fun. Enjoyed it, you know, and I was still working there. Because when you leave your work, like there's been times where I get back from a mission trip after a couple of months or the end of school, and I'm just so whooped out, I said, man, let me just take a day of rest. And that's the worst thing in the world I could do. Because once I take a day off, I don't know where to go from there. You know, I lost my whole vision, I lost my goal, I lost everything. So I don't like the idea of a vacation. There's no idea in the mind of a believer of retirement. You know, how do you retire from being a believer? You know, you retire when you sleep in the ground, that's retirement. You know, you may change your what you do, you might not do the same thing, you know, as you get older, but you change it. But that's why, like I said, always have your life in meaningful activities. This is the way to keep yourself sharp, and it helps. The second thing, so that's physical. Second thing is mental. Meditation on the Word daily, keeping your relationship with Yahweh strong, focusing on your core beliefs, long-term goals, relationship with people, and you have to keep your mind alert, sharp, alive, and active. You have to keep your mind alert, sharp, alive, and active. And they've done tests on this, and there's different aspects of your mind, and when you watch television, your mind becomes passive. You know, it doesn't, the active part becomes passive. Not to say there's never a time to watch something, but you have to understand what that does. You know, nothing else has to happen from there. But you want to keep your mind alert, sharp, alive, and active. And the third is spiritual. And with the meditation part, you know, you're thinking about your relationships. You're thinking about your relationship with Yahweh, with people. You're thinking about things we talked about today. Because a lot of how to instill what we're talking about today is mentally being aware of it. You know, like I say sometimes, even with breaking patterns, you know, like I say with anchors and breaking, you know, like you're sometimes just awareness is enough to break it. That someone doesn't know they're doing something. You know, you bite your fingernails. No, I don't. Oh, I do. And then just that awareness sometimes is enough to break that habit. So meditation helps you to think about these things and helps you to instill. So the third part is the spiritual reading. Your scriptures daily, but also books that inspire, like I said. You know, I have an Amish book that I'm on the third time going around with it. I love it. You know, it's all the stories that I put in the Remnant's Walks from there. And I just really, because the Amish, even though they're simple people, they really make you think. They really have deep things, you know, that they say. And I really enjoy that. It's almost like reading Proverbs to me by reading that. And reading the book of Proverbs is another one that helps you with these things. Listening to sermons that uplift. But the spiritual is not just scripture and prayer, that's the core of it. But like I said, it's other things that are going to make you understand the scripture and help your prayer life better and motivate and reinforce your value system. Strong spiritual friendships that inspire, help you challenge yourself and grow in spirit, keeping your relationship with Yahweh strong through prayer, fasting, and speaking with Him daily. Romans 6:16 says, "You are the servant of what you obey, and always remember private victories help to win public victories." Private victories help to win public victories. So if there's things in your life that you haven't overcome, no matter what it is, it could be greed, it could be lust, it could be anger, by winning that private victory, it helps you to win public victories. Because now you're going to serve better. You're going to be a better friend. You're going to be a better husband. You're going to be a better teacher. Whatever it is. So private victories help public victories. Must overcome, because what you don't overcome is going to overcome you. It's that simple. Whatever you don't overcome is going to overcome you. And we'll pick up tomorrow. There's no shortcuts. You know, repetition is the mother of skill. And there's just no shortcuts to it. Like I said, because Yahweh made us as creatures of habit, by instilling this in our nervous system over and over and over, our spiritual life to be reinforced that way. We want it to become a habit. And repetition is the mother of skill. The way to true change is to make your belief system a way of life. And you have to master in the basics. You know, you got to master in the basics. You know, studying the word, memorizing doctrines to become a master yourself. And that's why once you have the foundation, the Holy Spirit, everything you read, the Holy Spirit can bounce off you what it needs to tell you. But if you don't have that foundation, you can't do it. So, when we're looking at that idea of a habit, what is the definition of a habit? It's what we do repeatedly, right? A habit is something you do repeatedly, which tells you what? Excellence is not an act, but a habit. Excellence is not an act, but a habit. So when you see, what do I mean by this? When you see in the Olympics, and here he comes and he's running up, and he broke the world record, he ran the mile in 5:29. It was a habit, it wasn't an act. You know, you think that guy just came out of the stands, hey, you need to run a ride, I'll try. No, that guy spent his whole life, those gymnastic people, they spent their whole life, year after year, week after week, and hour after hour, for that one time. You know, the boxer that's in there, the pro boxer, you know, and it might not look far. Guy's there 3 minutes around, 15 rounds, fight with somebody, but well, do it. I did amateur boxing when I was younger, and you get tired really fast. So excellence is not an act, it's a habit. It's a habit. It's what you train your mind to do over and over and over. You have to repeat your habits daily to confirm and strengthen, like I said, our core beliefs and our values and not contradict them. Okay, we are going to stop there for today. I am going to open up.